From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The separation of church and state by the founders of the American Republic was a stunning innovation and the only original part of the Constitution. So says historian Gary Wills in his new book, Head and Heart, American Christianities. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Wills about how that separation came to be and why he considers it the great protector of religion, not its enemy. Also, epidemiologist Devra Davis. Her new book is The Secret History of the War on Cancer. She says we need to be much more deliberate in our study of possible carcinogens around us, like aspartame found in diet drinks and foods, radiation from X-rays, and microwaves from cell phones. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest historian Gary Wills has been thinking about the role of religion in public life, and he says the influence of evangelical Christians in the Bush administration is one of several periods in American history when religion has invaded the sphere of government. Earlier surges of evangelism, he argues, have always provoked a popular reaction which reduced their influence. Will's new book is Head and Heart, American Christianities. He says some modern evangelicals mistakenly believe the founders of the Republic were guided by biblical teaching, and that America has gradually lost its spiritual moorings. In fact, Will says the founders were not deeply religious, and their decision to separate religion from government actually helped America to become a deeply religious society. Gary Wills is a professor of history emeritus at Northwestern University. He's won many awards, including the Pulitzer Prize. Among his many other books are What Jesus Meant and Lincoln at Gettysburg. Well, Gary Wills, welcome back to Fresh Air. You had an encounter with the Dalai Lama in Chicago, which you write about early in this book, which yielded a point relevant to your subject. Would you describe that moment?
Well, yes. He came to Chicago and was scheduled to appear. And he said, I don't like to give formal addresses because they're boring and people fall asleep. So would you please have someone on the stage with me asking questions and I will respond? I was one of those on the stage, and we talked to him ahead of time, and he said, don't ask easy questions. Some people are too deferential to me, and that also is boring, and we all go to sleep. So ask a hard question. Well, the only question I could think of was, if you were restored to your country, what would you do different? And he said, I would disestablish the religion, because the American separation of church and state is the proper relationship between politics and religion.
This from a man of mystical faith. Did this surprise you?
Not surprised, but pleased. But on the way out, I said to him, for that, don't you have to have had an enlightenment, our 18th century scientific rational enlightenment? And he said, ah, there's the problem. And his very next book said that the Buddhists had not faced up to the difficulty of dealing with modern rationality and science. So he wanted to get to where we started, where we had the great luck to start in the 18th century with deist formulators of our government who knew that the best thing for religion is to separate it from the state. Both Madison and Jefferson said that religion will flourish if it is separated from the state, because in all of the governments that had established religions, religion became contaminated by politics, became corrupt, caused a reaction of anti-clericalism and disgust with the relationship between the two. And that has never happened in America, and no country, no developed country, has a higher degree of religious profession and attendance than the United States. And it's really, I think, due to the fact that we did have a separation of church and state.
Well, you write early in the book that this separation of church and state, which, you know, we use the shorthand disestablishment for, you say it was a stunning innovation and the only original part of the Constitution. What do you mean?
That's right. No other country before ours had dared to launch itself without formal protection by God, by some official religion. Everything else in the Constitution, the tripartite government, the independent judiciary, federalism, bicameralism in the legislature, all of those things had been around for a long time. And the only thing that was new was to say, we don't need an official cult. And a lot of people said, of course you do. How could you hope to flourish if God is not blessing you? Well, we launched it, and it worked.
And you note that this innovation, the separation of church and state, could have only occurred at this particular moment in our history. What was unique about that moment?
Well, You know, we have a myth in America that we began as a very religious country and we've been declining in religiosity ever since, which is the exact opposite of the truth. We were at our lowest level of religiosity in the 1770s when 17% of the people were churchgoers. And our profession and practice of religion took off like crazy after the Constitution was founded. A tremendous explosion in the early 19th century, the Methodist explosion especially, when there were more Methodist pastors than post office officials. And the thing is that it would have been hard to persuade religious people that they could get along without an official cult at any other time. But the deist founders, and they were all deists, which doesn't mean atheists, they were rational believers, were the ones who were able to pull off this really astonishing new thing.
And since you raised the subject, I mean, people have talked about the founders of the Republic as being deists. What exactly did that mean?
Well, they believed that God did create the world and supervises it, governs it. They believed in providence, so that Thomas Paine, for instance, said that he can't believe that God is not on the side of freedom, not so much as a matter of this government or that government, but just in general. And they believed in the afterlife. They didn't, most of them, believe in God's responding to prayer. They said, you know, God knows what's best. He doesn't wait for us to ask him to do something and then does it on our bidding. They didn't believe in the particulars of Christian revelation. They believed that Jesus, well, Locke believed that Jesus was the Messiah who had been promised in Jewish scripture, but that he was not God incarnate, that he was an important moral leader singled out by God. Jefferson thought that he was the most perfect moral teacher, but was simply a perfect man, not God. So they had various degrees of recognition of God's intervention in human life, but most of them thought that established churches were corrupt, and we shouldn't believe what they say, that we should believe our reason. We know that God is around and made the world because the world works so beautifully, and nobody could do that without him.
And so the imperative for those of us here below was to live moral lives, and we would be rewarded with an afterlife?
That's right. Jefferson said to Adams when Abigail Adams died, "It's a terrible blow that you've received, but we'll soon be joining her in the afterlife and enjoy her company forever." So they did have some very important and emotional religious beliefs.
You dwell at some length on the separation of state and religion by the founders of the Republic, and it's interesting that you note early on that the logic of having an established religion is simple and appealing. What is the logic?
Well, that if you do not pay right deference to God, he will not bless your endeavors. And therefore, you must make sure that the state is properly deferential to God. The thinking there is that God will only bless a nation, a polity, if there is a formal recognition of him. The trouble with that, of course, is that there's been formal recognition of him by every state that preceded ours, and obviously he's not protecting them all, because when two of them fight with each other, one wins. And therefore, the magic didn't work.
Now, at the time that, at the founding of the Republic, of course, there were governments already in place up and down the colonies. How much religious freedom was allowed then in the laws and charters and practice of the individual colonies?
Well, as I say, the separation of church and state was a brand new idea. So in the colonies, it had not been observed. There were official religions in many colonies. There were conditions for holding office that said you had to believe in the Trinity or you had to believe in Jesus Christ. And the first one that really broke away from that was the state of Virginia. Jefferson wrote a statute of religious freedom, which he tried to get through, and he didn't at first, and he said it was the hardest fight of his life because it was so resented in Virginia. But when he had left and gone to France as our legate, Madison finally got it through. And that was the first one. The first one in history and in the world that had a real religious freedom statute.
You know, and you focus on a piece, a petition drafted by James Madison, which was, you know, not from the Constitutional Convention, but from that he did in opposition to a Virginia tax that was to be levied to support ministers. And you call his arguments the best exposition of the thought that would lie behind the drafting of the First Amendment, and in fact, the best arguments for separation of church and state that have ever been written. What did Madison say in this draft?
Well, he said what Jefferson said, that no one can take away the right of the individual to worship God in whatever way he or she wants. But he spells it out in great detail, and he says religion, the state should have no cognizance of religion. It should not know about it even. It should just keep its hands off. So much so that later on he said, it's better when we have the census of American citizens, which is mandated in the Constitution, that religious ministers not give their profession, because the state has no business knowing that. It has no business knowing anything about religion. It should just keep entirely away from it. Now, that seems very extreme to most people, and we have not observed it in our history. He didn't want, for instance, to have chaplains who wore the uniform of the United States and took salaries from the United States, although they were religious pastors. He didn't want chaplains in the Congress. He didn't want tax exemption for churches. We've never gone that far in following his principles, but logically, we should have. And it's always been dangerous not to. More and more, as this new idea came over us, we began to accept it. Now, when I was a young person in school, I knew many of my friends who were in public schools and had to say the Our Father every day, or they had to do other religious practices. We don't do that anymore. And that was resisted mightily when the Supreme Court said that we should stop doing it.
How did people in the colonies react to a constitution that did not mention God?
Some were very upset, of course. But all that the Constitutional Convention could say is that the federal government will make no law about religion, which left the individual states, of course, to keep established religions so far as they had them still. And some people have actually claimed that the constitutional arrangement was to allow the states to keep their own establishment. Well, we know that was not Madison's view because of what he had already done in the state of Virginia, and he thought, obviously, that other states should do that too. But it took a while for the states to disestablish their own religion practices, and as time went by, the federal government was applied to the state level through the 14th Amendment, and now we have the disestablishment applying to us all.
You know, there is a notion among, I guess, some historians that the separation of religion from government was a necessary accommodation to the proliferation of religions and sects up and down the colonies, that it wasn't principle, it was pragmatism.
Yes, that's a very common idea, that we did have different religions. We had Catholics in Maryland, we had Quakers in Pennsylvania, we had Calvinists all through New England, we had Anglicans in New York and in the southern, and therefore there couldn't have been one established religion. And that's the only reason. But that's not the argument that was made by Jefferson and Madison or others. And as a matter of fact, when the Constitution was ratified, various states sent in objections to things, and none of them argued that you've got to protect our established church in our state. That was not what the argument was about. So at the time, no one was really promoting this new idea on the grounds that it was a necessary compromise. They were promoting it in principle, that freedom of conscience had to be respected.
We're speaking with Gary Wills. His new book is called Head and Heart, American Christianities. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Gary Wills. His new book is called Head and Heart, American Christianities. I mean, if the founders believed in this more rational notion of God, that he was revealed through reason and study, you write that as the Republic progressed, there have been periods of evangelistic fervor. I mean, the Second Great Awakening in the early 19th century, and then again in the early 20th century when there was all of the revivalism which led to prohibition of alcohol. What was the reaction of the Republic and the population generally to this spirit of evangelism, and what was the effect of that reaction on the strength of religion in the Republic?
Well, one of the problems with enlightened religion that it seems too cool and desiccated and cerebral, and it doesn't have a religion of the heart, and therefore there's a great appeal in the revivalistic strain that I choose Jesus and the Spirit chooses me, and I don't wait for an outside intellectual to tell me what God is like. So always that is there. So I describe a kind of two poles of attraction in America between the head and the heart. And sometimes it becomes really ardent. The Second Great Awakening was one of those cases. The fundamentalist movement at the beginning of the 20th century, and right recently, the religious right. All of those have gone to excess, it seems to me, and the reaction to the fundamentalist movement with prohibition and the Scopes trial and things like that was, wait a minute, this has gone too far. And the reaction to the religious right recently has been on the Terry Schiavo case, for instance. The 81% of the people in America said that they disagreed with Congress interfering in the Terry Schiavo case. And a number of moderate Republican religious people have begun to say we've gone too far in this kind of vendetta against gays, etc.
So it's not the growth of evangelistic feeling that produces the reaction, but breaching the wall of separation with the state that really...
Sure, there's nothing wrong with religious feeling, but when it starts trying to take over the functions of government, then people begin to have some misgivings.
What evidence do you see that there is a reaction now against the Bush administration's embrace of evangelicals?
Well, as I say, the moderate religious people have started shifting their emphases, if not actually renouncing what had gone before. For instance, there's a whole evangelical group that is saying the environmental measures of the Bush administration have gone way too far. And that was always something that the religious right had been involved in their view of dominion over nature. That has changed. The saliency of the gay issue and the abortion issue have diminished in polls. So they're running out of steam, and they're becoming more uneasy about what they've got themselves in for. So one of the things that Rove was good at was to rev up the troops on all kinds of issues without getting too much into the concerns of the independents so that they would rebel against this. Well, that's not happening anymore. They are rebelling against it.
Well, and you find very significant the statements of Senator John Danforth here. Why do you cite those?
Well, he is such a stalwart of the conservatives. You know, he brought a suit against Roe v. Wade. He supported Clarence Thomas for the Supreme Court. He's a very long-standing, important member of the religious right. And for him to say, we've gone too far, folks, we've got to stop this, is very significant.
Well, Gary Wills, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Historian Gary Wills. His new book is Head and Heart, American Christianities. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of Husbandry, Sex, Love, and Dirty Laundry, Inside the Minds of Married Men by Stephen Fried. From Carpenter Company, maker of bed pillows and other innovative products designed to help people sleep better. Z-score test and sleep tips available at carpenter.com. And from TIAA Cref, putting the heart of a nonprofit to work for the financial future of those who serve the greater good. That's powerof.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Epidemiologist Devra Davis believes the war on cancer may be overlooking many things which could cause cancer. The aspartame used in diet products, chemicals used to make fabric fire retardant, and yes, maybe even cell phones. Coming up, we'll talk with Davis about her new book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Devra Davis says Americans have spent $40 billion in a war on cancer, fighting the wrong battles with the wrong weapons against the wrong enemies. Davis says the effort has focused on detecting, treating, and curing the disease instead of looking at what causes it. Her book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer, argues powerful economic interests have steered money toward research on treatment rather than looking at how their own products may be causing the disease. And she says we're surrounded by potentially cancer-causing products we ought to be paying more attention to. Devra Davis is the director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute. She spoke with Terry Gross.
Devra Davis, welcome to Fresh Air. Are there specific cancers that have risen the most in the past few years?
Well, one of them is testicular cancer. I mean, Lance Armstrong is a hero for many reasons, having survived advanced cancer. But in every industrial country that we know of, testicular cancer rates have increased dramatically in the past 20 years. Another, we've seen increases in and lower ages for bone cancer. Multiple myeloma is a cancer of the bone marrow, one that unfortunately killed my father, that he developed when he was just in his mid-50s. And my colleagues at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute are seeing younger and younger cases of multiple myeloma. We're seeing more of them, unfortunately, in people who worked at Ground Zero, which is really astonishing given how recently they were exposed to things there.
I'm surprised you haven't mentioned breast cancer.
Well, whether or not breast cancer is increasing, there's, believe it or not, a debate. And that has to do with the fact that mammography allows us to find things earlier and earlier. And we are finding things, particularly in white women who are getting screened more. So whether there's an increase in breast cancer recently or not, the issue is very simple. Only 1 out of 10 women who get breast cancer today gets it because she was born with a defect in her genes. That means that 9 out of 10 women who end up with breast cancer were born with healthy genes. And yet cancer is a disease that only happens when your healthy genes stop doing their job of extinguishing bad cell growth. So we have to ask, what's happening for the 9 out of 10 women who were born with healthy genes to give them breast cancer? And we know that some of the things that are involved can be related to hormones, both natural hormones in the body and synthetic ones that we may give people in the form of other drugs or chemicals that can act like hormones when you're exposed to them. Now, breast cancer patterns are, frankly, quite puzzling because we don't know why more young black women get breast cancer than more young white women. For all the risk factors that we know of, for example, having children earlier in life should protect you against breast cancer, young black women tend to have fewer of those risk factors. And yet, in some areas of the country, like my state of Pennsylvania, almost twice as many young black women under the age of 40 get breast cancer when compared with young white women. We don't have an explanation for that. In the book, I talk about hormone-containing personal care products as one thing that we need to understand better because it is part of the culture of African-American young women to go to the beauty parlor, often at a very young age. And in one small study that Dr. Chandra Tiwari did, he was a pediatric endocrinologist in the military, he found 4 black baby girls between the ages of 1 year and 3 years with breasts.
What's the connection between this and going to the beauty parlor?
He learned that their mothers were putting creams on their scalp designed to make their hair softer and smoother. And the creams said on the label contain live placenta extract. So these same creams are some of the creams that used to be used in African-American hair care salons. Now, I have to say used to be used because we tried and failed to do a study on this subject. We couldn't get people to tell us what was in the products. They don't have to tell you. There's no requirement for labeling in the United States, and there's no monitoring whatsoever for what's in our beauty products, unlike Europe. And as a consequence, we don't know whether or not today residues from hormones found in hair care products could explain some of the increased risk of breast cancer that we're seeing in young black girls.
When you say that there used to be a placenta extract in these hair products that contains estrogen, the placenta extract?
Well, the placenta, you know, is the furnace that fuels the growth of the baby, and it's full of blood and hormones of all kinds. So it's basically full of estrogen and other hormones, by the way. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about this small study that I've written about with Dr. Tiwari is that when the mothers stopped using the cream, the breasts went away. Now ask yourself, if something can cause breasts to grow on babies, what could it be doing to the rest of us? And the fact that the breasts went away when they stopped using the cream makes it very clear. It's a rather unusual demonstration that that cream was causing this breast growth in these little girls.
One of the points you make in your book is that scientists tend to look at what this chemical causes cancer-wise or if that chemical causes cancer. And one of your points is we should also be looking at the cumulative exposure to smaller amounts of different chemicals. That smaller amounts of a variety of chemicals, when taken together, can be as harmful as exposure to a large dose of a single carcinogen. So where does that leave you in terms of trying to analyze how the cumulative effect of exposure to smaller doses of a variety of carcinogens?
It leaves us with the challenges of public health research. We are now starting a national children's study, unless this administration doesn't fund it, which is a real threat, to look at people throughout their lifetimes so that we can chart the combined effects. But as I say, life is a mixture. And as a consequence, when we study one chemical at a time, that doesn't tell us what life is really going to throw at us. Cigarette smoke is a consummate example. It's a mixture. Air pollution is another. It's a mixture. Studying these things in the real world is the only way we're going to get a handle on their effect. Having said that, though, we also need to understand that requiring proof of sick or dead people before acting to prevent future harm is a fundamentally wrong approach to public health.
But you have to have proof before you ban a chemical, right?
Well, what is proof? Do you have to have proof in the form of sick or dead people? Or is proof, for example, taking a group of cells like my scientists do at our center, studying them in the laboratory, seeing what happens to them and what happens to them when you expose them to a chemical or expose them to a protective chemical like the ones we're developing from broccoli and garlic and fish oil and chocolate, which look, by the way, like they're protecting against cancer growth. So I think we have to make better use of experimental research in cell cultures, in whole animals, with computers. And that way we get away from insisting that the only proof we can accept is a sick or dead person.
Devra Davis speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with epidemiologist Devra Davis. Her new book is The Secret History of the War on Cancer.
Let's look at some of the common chemicals that are in things that we use or eat on a regular basis that we might not be thinking about, but you are thinking about as possible carcinogens. Let's start with food and with the artificial sugar substitute, the sweetener aspartame. How concerned are you about that, and what are some of the things that it's in?
I'm very concerned about aspartame, and as I say in the book, aspartame only got approved by the government when Donald Rumsfeld became the CEO of the Searle Company in between his service in the government. And it was never recommended for approval by any scientific group that reviewed the data on it at the time. Most recently, there's now a new study that's come out that did something rather unusual. Looking at animals that lived through their natural lifetime, 3 years, they found a significant number of tumors in those animals in their third year of life. Now, the typical animal study stops at 2 years. You often hear about how there's so many high doses of these things in these animal studies. Well, that's not the case for the aspartame studies that have just been completed in Italy. If you had two cans of diet soda a day, you would get 400 milligrams of aspartame. And unfortunately, there are people, and we've seen them all, who go out and order chocolate cake with Diet Coke. And they think that they're doing themselves a favor. Well, the reality is the Diet Coke doesn't seem to help anybody lose weight. I don't know of any studies that suggest that using diet soda helps people lose weight. And the studies that have been done that have been negative in humans on aspartame, and they are all negative, have been things like asking people who were volunteers for the AARP, the retired people, right, 500,000 of them, if they had been drinking aspartame drinks in 1995 and 96, and then 5 years later, seeing if they had brain cancer.
And that's not a reliable test?
Well, we know that brain cancer can take 20, 30, or 40 years to develop. I'm very concerned about the generations of young children and pregnant women who are using aspartame now starting in childhood and what this will mean when they reach their 60s and 70s. Because we are living longer, because we've wiped out infectious diseases. And some cancers are dropping because we have dropped smoking rates and we have improved the ability to find and treat colorectal cancer and I think breast cancer. But aspartame is a ticking time bomb. And if we wait till we have proof of human harm for aspartame, it will be far too late to put that genie back in the bottle.
What are some of the common household products, cleaning products that we typically use that may have carcinogens in them, chemicals that you are concerned about?
Well, if something can cut through grease, it's often based on a chlorinated compound. It can slice through. And if it has a skull and crossbones on it, if it says, don't breathe, use in good ventilation, then ask yourself whether you need to use it and whether there's a safer substitute. I buy baking soda by 10-pound quantities. And you can do many things with baking soda. For example, you can use baking soda the way you could use a lot of common cleansers and Comet and things of that sort. You can use toothpaste to clean silver. So there are a lot of less toxic things we can use for cleaning in our homes. And right now, the biggest growth in manufacturing is in green products. Now, of course, having said that, we want to make sure they're really green. And that's where I think there's a role for the industry to do a better job of monitoring itself and where the government may have a job to play as well.
Do the mold, mildew kind of products that you're supposed to use on your bathroom tiles, and they warn you to have good ventilation, do they fall in the same category that you're describing?
They often do, but I think that's where the market is working, if I may say, because you'll see a tremendous growth in green products now that are being formulated to be less damaging to the skin and eyes. And if it can kill mold, if it can kill pests, then you have to ask what it's doing to us. At the same token, we have to kill mold. Mold can actually be very dangerous to your health. So there are trade-offs for all of these things. And I'm not in the business of formulating products. I am in the business of evaluating the impact on our lives of the things that we use now. And we know that moving to less toxic cleaning products generally is a good idea.
My guest is Devra Davis. She's the director of the Center for Environmental Oncology at the University of Pittsburgh's Cancer Institute. And she's the author of the new book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. What's your take on diagnostic radiation like X-rays?
What we know now, in the American College of Radiology has issued a warning on this, is that we are using far too much diagnostic radiation. And they are warning that current patterns of use of CT scans will increase our cancer burden in the future, and particularly warning about pediatric CT scans. CT scanning of little babies is obviously necessary when you've got a newborn, when you've got a preemie, and you want to find out if they've got all their organs intact. That's different from the routine use that we are seeing of CT scans for things like cranky knees and aching backs. When my daughter was 11 years old and she had potentially a ruptured spleen, they wanted to do a CT scan, and I wanted to protect her breasts. And the young woman radiologist said, why are you bothering? She doesn't have any. And I explained that that's exactly when you have to protect the breast of a young girl, when the breast is getting ready to grow, because that's when it's most vulnerable to the effects of radiation. Most physicians today do not get trained on the dangers of overuse of diagnostic radiation. The American College of Radiology is hardly a radical group, and they are warning now and asking for a summit meeting with emergency room doctors because they recognize that emergency room doctors who order these things aren't fully aware of the lifetime risks.
What about MRIs, magnetic resonance imaging? Do you think that those are safer?
They're certainly safer. There's no question of that. And the problem is emergency room doctors have CT scans, radiation scans, operating 24 hours a day. MRI machines in many hospitals aren't operating 24 hours a day. Ultrasound, which sometimes can give you good images as well, is not generally operating 24/7. They also don't necessarily give you as much information. So I'm not obviously can't be opposed to CT scans. They've revolutionized medicine. But they are being overused, and that's why there's two things happening. The American College of Radiology has called for a summit meeting with emergency room physicians to come up with agreements about protocols about when and whether and how you should be using CT scans. But there's also legislation that's locked up in Congress right now because there are no federal standards for training and certification of CT technicians right now. I was involved in developing and trying to implement the national standards for mammography. There were no national standards for mammography until 1994 in the United States. I visited a clinic in Arkansas where the office receptionist could give you a mammogram.
I'm glad you brought up mammograms. It's very controversial now how often women should get it, at what age they should get it, because of the risks of exposure to radiation and also because it's unclear how helpful the mammograms are in actually, you know, avoiding cancer. So what's your take on who and should get mammograms and how often they should get them?
Mammograms save lives in women after menopause. I don't think there's any debate about that. And the amount of radiation in modern equipment today is so much lower than it was in the past. It's phenomenal. Having said that, though, getting mammograms before age 40 is a bad idea. And unfortunately, we're seeing increasing moves to do that, particularly, ironically, in young black women who tend to have more dense breasts. The denser the breast, the harder it is for the X-ray to see through it. And young women should not be getting routine mammograms. But any woman at any age that has a symptom and a problem may need a mammogram and should see a health professional. Everybody has different risk factors that have to be taken into account. But a lot of physicians do not realize that radiation to the breast of a young woman can be problematic. And screening mammography, which means taking people without any symptoms and giving them mammograms, is a very important thing to do for women just prior to menopause and throughout menopause. And knowing when you should have regular mammograms or not is a decision women should make in consultation with their physicians. But growing numbers of breast cancer organizations, like the National Breast Cancer Coalition, are warning that mammography has been oversold and understudied. And that's a classic example of what we've done with CT scans as well. We push technologies, and it's like we've done fire and then ready and aim. We don't set up the system to study something before we make it widespread. We did it with hormone replacement therapy. We're doing it with CT scans now. And we did it with mammograms in young women. And our ability to study the impact of these technologies on our health is really limited because of the way we've started with the technology, pushing it into use before studying it.
Devra Davis speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Terry's interview with epidemiologist Devra Davis. Her new book is The Secret History of the War on Cancer.
I'm going to bring up a subject that I think our listeners will be unhappy to hear your concerns about, and that's cell phones. Why are you worried about cell phones?
Well, first of all, cell phones clearly save lives. And as I say in the book, those records of those phone calls left by people in 9/11 are really wrenching and would never have been able to be possible without cell phones. At this point, I can't tell you that cell phones are harmful, but I can't tell you that they're safe either. And we are not studying the problem in a broad enough way to resolve the question.
What's the problem? The microwaves?
Cell phones basically use the head as an antenna. A number of countries recommend that children not use cell phones right now. Bangalore, India. bans the sale of cell phones to children under the age of 16. The British government recommends against children using cell phones, and they do this because the cell signal does penetrate the brain. Any of you who use cell phones a lot and feel that heat and warmth that comes from particularly the older generation of cell phones knows that you're warming the brain. And studying brain cancer in epidemiology is one of the toughest things we do because brain cancer takes a long time to develop, sometimes perhaps 40 years. So we're in the midst.
Can I stop you? It doesn't necessarily follow to me that even if a cell phone's warm, it means your brain is warm?
It penetrates 1 inch into the brain.
Oh.
The industry acknowledges that.
But the microwaves,
the industries,
too? The microwaves?
That the signal from this phone gets 1 inch into the brain. Yes. That's their own data. Now, we have no way to know what this means for the long term. But I want to tell you that there have been a number of highly publicized negative studies that I think are very questionable. One, which was by the Danish Cancer Society, made headlines just a year ago. Cell phones don't cause brain cancer. But let's look at what they did in that particular study. They looked at about 500,000 people who had first signed up to use cell phones between 1982 and 1995. And a user in their study was defined as someone who didn't use a phone for business. Now, that doesn't make any sense, because, of course, business users would be the biggest users of phones. And they did not find an increase in brain cancer when they did this study. But in fact, the study was very biased against finding a problem because they stopped their analysis in 1995. And look around and you see that we are completely inundated with cell phones. And many countries, like Israel and China and India, are using cell phones and not landlines at all. When you're trying to study a problem, you want to get a group of people with high exposures to compare with others who have no exposures.
What you recommend, I think, is wearing an earpiece so that you're separated from the radio waves that send the signal to the telephone. So is that a wire earpiece? Like if you're using one of those wireless earpieces, are you still being exposed to the problem or the potential problem?
I'm sure your risk is less. And I don't know, and there are variations on those wired pieces as well, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not an electrical engineer. I'm raising a question because I think as a democratic society, we ought to be able to answer it. And I'm very, very concerned about the marketing of cell phones to young children. And many nations are recommending against cell phone use for children for a number of reasons, including the potential long-term risks to their brain development, which could include cancer, but not cancer only.
I know you're concerned about how much teeth the regulatory agencies really have. And you're concerned right now about the Consumer Product Safety Commission. What's your concern there?
Well, they have to get lead out of children's toys, and they need the authority to measure and monitor a whole bunch of things that may be contaminants in children's toys, including some plastics and other things. But right now, there's new legislation pending to give them that authority. But at the end, there's tacked on a very, very bad idea, which is that we should mandate national standards to put flame retardant chemicals into furniture. This is a bad idea because these chemicals have been banned in Sweden and other places because they are shown to accumulate in breast milk, to damage the brains of animals, and suspected of increasing the risk of cancer and thyroid diseases in children. The chemicals aren't needed because you can engineer fabric to self-extinguish. And now the cigarette manufacturers are about to announce a national issuance of cigarettes that are self-extinguishing. That was the major cause of fires in furniture. People would fall asleep with a lit cigarette. If you have self-extinguishing cigarettes, you don't need to put millions of pounds of toxic chemicals into furniture to make them flame retardant. The whole flame retardant chemical business can be rethought with green products that engineer fabric so that it is designed not to burn. Because these flame retardants work for 12 seconds, and then when they do catch fire, which they often do, they release dioxin, which I think most people know is not a good thing. IKEA right now was using flame retardants and is now no longer using them because they've figured out a way to do it. They've done it in Europe. we in the United States can have as safe materials as they do in Europe. I don't think there's any reason we can't. And we should not require that chemicals be put into our furniture that we know are going to be bad for ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren.
I will bet you that a lot of people listening to us now are thinking, I give up. You know, if there's problems with all the things that she says there's problems with, then what am I going to eat? What am I going to clean with? What am I going to call people with? I mean, there's so many things that you're saying are potentially carcinogenic that it's just easy to throw up your hands and say, well, there's just like too much to cut out. I can't deal with it, so I'm just going to ignore it all.
Well, you know, there's a Chinese proverb that a long journey begins with a first step. And I think that this is how you deal with breast cancer. This is how you deal with any disease, one step at a time. People have to decide what steps they can take. And I think there are practical solutions that people are going to make a lot of money by implementing these practical solutions. We still have one of the greatest countries in the world, one of the strongest economies in the world. And we are coming up with new solutions and new products and new ways to deal with old problems. Einstein said you can't solve the problems of the present and the future with the technologies that created them. And I think we are moving in that direction now. And people have to do what they're comfortable doing.
Deborah Davis, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Deborah Davis speaking with Terry Gross. Davis's new book is The Secret History of the War on Cancer. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and John Sheehan. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
During World War II, Nazis exported their anti-Semitic policies to North Africa. They deprived Jews of civil rights, confiscated their property, and forced them into labor camps. On the next Fresh Air, the untold stories of Arabs who helped rescue Jews. We talk with Robert Satloff, author of Among the Righteous. Join us for the next Fresh Air.